This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 22nd, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 440 and happy spring. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, Professor Christian Luprecht returns for a look at geopolitics at the end of the first quarter of 2026. What are the ramifications for Canada and the upcoming FIFA World Cup?
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast, and we're welcoming back Professor Christian Luprecht to talk about geopolitics from a Canadian perspective. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science and Economics at Royal Military College of Canada and senior fellow with MacDonald Laurier Institute. He was a guest on the podcast last November. He was in Vancouver in October for the Security Summit in Vancouver and the Vancouver International Security Summit. And we talked to him there after the conference. And last June, before the G7 summit in Alberta, I asked him then about how Canada was seen in the world and where the world was heading. Now, speaking of where the world is heading, it's been a very tumultuous first quarter of 2026. We're almost at the end of the first quarter. It started actually last December at the FIFA World Cup draw. Donald Trump won the first and so far only FIFA Peace Prize in December. And then January, the invasion of Venezuela. And then in February, the invasion of Iran. That sparked a Middle East conflict where Iran is retaliating across the region. And we're seeing the results in our communities at our gas pumps. That's one of the ways this conflict is manifesting itself. Meanwhile, the war in Ukraine continues. It started a fifth year since Russia and its invasion of Ukraine in 2022. And there is also another conflict, Pakistan and Afghanistan, but that's moving into a ceasefire this week. Whether it holds or not, we'll have to wait and see. So I'll ask you the question I asked you back in June of last year, Christian. Are we in World War III?
Well, certainly states are back and they're back in force. And there's probably not a U.S. president that has used the U.S. military as an instrument of statecraft the way this president does. And so when you're using the armed forces as a tool of statecraft, I mean, he's probably emboldened by, Russia sort of doing likewise. And it's probably also an indication of a very competitive world. Where the current president clearly felt that the United States was reacting to events in the world and that adversaries had the initiative and that the United States needed to take the initiative. And one of the ways the United States takes initiative traditionally is through its armed forces. There's a reason the United States keeps the largest military in the world. Allies and partners are nice to have, but ultimately if the U.S. wants to look out for its interests, that it's able to do so, and it's able to do so on its own if it chooses to do so. And of course, that's exactly the rhetoric that you get from President Trump. I think he might be able to get away with that in the short term, but in the medium term, it turns out you always need you need allies and partners. Strictly speaking, I mean, it's not World War III in the sense that nobody's declared war because only Congress can declare war. So we might call it that, observing it or so, but strictly speaking, nobody's declared war. At the same time, of course, we always think about, you know, I don't think we've really had peace on this planet in decades. If you look at, we always want Canada to go on peacekeeping missions, but there's been no peace to keep. We have ceasefires in different places sort of in the world. And in many ways, it's a global conflict in the sense that we're on the front lines. We're on the front lines in part because of what you and I are doing now. That I'd like to say the most important instrument of statecraft is the information domain in the 21st century. and look at the amount of misinformation that we got and we continue to get about conflict in the Middle East from various sides, does it meet? I mean, I think the conflict is still quite confined. We don't see the sort of mass casualties that we would have seen sort of in last world viewers. But I also, now when I had this conversation recently on our public broadcaster, I also pointed out that I think we have a very simplistic way of Canadians at looking at war and peace. This very dyadic sort of black and white. And I would say that much of what we see in the world today is neither war nor peace, but that most of it is actually some gray zone of conflict in between. That Russia and China understand themselves to be at war with us. It's just they have a different understanding of what it means to be at war, that the information domain, the psychological domain, law and lawfare, that those are all instruments of conflict and war from a Chinese perspective in ways that we just don't seem to grasp. So is it World War III? I think that's taking a moniker from the past and trying to superimpose it on a problem, the conflict of the 21st century, to which I think it's not all that applicable because we have trouble with the terminology and because what we see doesn't fit the worldview of how we would as Canadians like to see the world, which is to see a world of war and of peace. And we have a hard time coming to terms with the fact that we live in neither a time of war nor a time of peace.
And this current war, the United States and Israel on Iran, is really in many ways an extension of October 7th. You know, Hamas invaded Israel, killed innocent Israelis, Israel retaliated, and since then Israel has been battling on many fronts, on not only trying to get Hamas under control in Gaza, but also in Lebanon, and now for the second time retaliating against Iran. And this time they took out the Ayatollah with American help.
And you see this increasing. Israel and the United States may be in this fight together, but they have very different interests. Israel wants to create a neighborhood that is more congenial and less hostile. The United States, I think, wants to reshape the Middle East because it realizes its geostrategic interests are in the Indo-Pacific, and yet it keeps getting drawn back into the Middle East. And so I think the Trump perspective is we're going to need to reshape the Middle East so that we can focus on what actually matters, which is the competition with China. We can't keep expending our military assets and resources on the Middle East. So I think that's and you can see this with, you know, Iran is attacking oil and Israel is attacking oil and gas installations, and Iran retaliates, and Trump is furious because, to the contrary, that's not Trump's objective. He just wants an Iranian regime that's going to be more sympathetic to the U.S. The same way he's trying to get out of Venezuela and what he's trying to get out of Cuba.
U.S. politicians did not vote on this war. It didn't go to the United Nations. This happened after the Olympics, before the Paralympics, but it still was within the United Nations and the International Olympic Committee's Olympic truce period. We saw in previous Olympic cycles how it was Vladimir Putin and Russia that was violating the Olympic truce, most recently with the invasion of Ukraine back in 2022. Now, Canada is not actively supporting the U.S. and Israel mission. It's on the sidelines. There have been statements from the Canadian government that have said that it's good that there could be regime change in Iran because of what the Islamic regime has meant to Iranians as well as to the Middle East for so many decades. But we also had a situation where Canadian soldiers were in Kuwait at a military installation and were under attack, and we didn't find out from official Canadian government sources about that. And Mark Carney came under some criticism for that.
There's still the risk that the government might be conveying the idea that these are other people's problems and this is a conflict far away. And of course, the problem is these conflicts never stay where they are. As you pointed out, you know, you see the repercussions at the gas pump. You're going to see the repercussions in a matter of weeks and months, in particular in Africa, but in Asia, where if this goes on and the price stays high, people are going to go hungry and you're going to have riots and serious political instability that we're ultimately going to have to rein in somehow, because it's not in our interest to have that instability. That Camp Canada in Kuwait, as you pointed out, ended up being targeted, whether probably unintentionally. They probably just targeted the camp sort of more broadly. And of course, look, I mean, Canada has interests in the Middle East. We effectively invented peacekeeping in 1956, the Suez Crisis, to stop the superpowers from going to war, let alone nuclear war. And we've had missions in the Middle East ever since, UN missions, military missions, the anti-ISIS mission. So the premise that somehow, you know, these are other people's problems, we'll just leave it up to them. I would say this is partially also what's gotten us into the pickle that we're in today, that for 25, 30 years, Canada and allies have kind of left the world up to the Americans, sort of, you know, you go look after it. And, you know, some of the stuff you do, we like, some of the stuff we don't like, but ultimately, you know, you just look after it, right? It's like, and I think we're realizing that that's probably not served us well. And you can see a much clearer position now from our European allies, led by Chancellor Merz, on that Germany will not participate in a naval mission. You see clear signaling from our allies in the Indo-Pacific. And I think Canada is still doing the quintessential Canadian thing. We try to figure out where the wind is blowing today, and then we kind of try to find the narrative and the rhetoric that sort of aligns with the way the wind is blowing today, in the hopes that sort of we can thread the needle, keep Washington happy, keep our European allies happy, and play sort of the middle power sort of card about, like, you know, it's funny, we always refer to ourselves as the middle power, but when it comes to these sorts of things, then we kind of pretend that we're actually too small to matter. And yet when it comes to our sovereignty, it turns out that we haven't built the instruments of statecraft that we could and should in order to assert ourselves. So if we're going to be a middle power and the world is apparently rupturing, then actually let's act like one, and let's speak up, let's take a position, let's act responsibly and defend our interests, defend our sovereignty, defend our values. You know, I think that's perhaps part politics. It's part electoral politics. You don't want to alienate electorates. And it's the challenge of also foreign policy in a very diverse country, where inherently, no matter what decision you make, you're going to be having someone who's going to be very unhappy. And I think that's all the more reason why I think this, what we saw over the last decade, where we basically made foreign policy an extension of domestic policy, has not served this country well. I have a sense the prime minister is trying to disentangle himself from that, but he's having considerable trouble, likely because of his own caucus and cabinet, all of whom, of course, represent ridings, and for all of whom have been socialized into this idea that somehow foreign policy is an extension of domestic policy, and who are and for whom the narrative that the prime minister presents and the decisions that he makes has real consequences in their local ridings for a government that is clearly desperate to get a majority. And so I think we're falling back into this trap of basically letting electoral constituencies and kind of determine what's in their best interest rather than what's in the national best interest.
Also in the first quarter, and it's been lost in some ways just because of our accelerated news cycles and other events that have happened around the world, but back in February, the Mexican government's crackdown on the cartels in Jalisco province, in Guadalajara and Puerto Vallarta especially, and that directly affected Canadians who were either holidaying down there or Canadians that now live in that region. They were directly affected. They witnessed some of the violence that happened. If they didn't witness it, then they were stuck there sheltering in place or not able to come back to Canada for a longer period of time than they'd hoped for. Now, that happened then. The cartels, of course, are criminal organizations. Their arms reach all the way into Canada and Canadian communities. We see that on the downtown east side of Vancouver, the horrors of drug use and and drug trafficking. And you can draw a straight line between Canadian organized crime and the Mexican cartels, who are the main suppliers in this hemisphere, with help from China and precursor chemicals. Now, this happens to be within a couple of months of the FIFA World Cup happening mostly in the United States. Mexico and Canada are junior partners. What does all this mean for the World Cup and how this is going to be organized, especially how this is going to be properly secured?
Well, look at the statements coming out of the Trump administration. Clearly, they perceive that Mexico has been much more constructive and engaged with the United States than Canada has, which is interesting because you would look ideologically at the administration that's in charge in Mexico and you would think that them and the Trump administration couldn't possibly get along. But just based on the statements that that the Trump administration itself has said, that the trade negotiations have been reasonably constructive with Mexico, and clearly Mexico has ponied up when it comes to U.S. interests in terms of cartels and is willing to, I mean, the Mexicans would have known that it's like these sorts of arrests are going to create serious backlash and violence. And at the same time, it looks like there's close collaboration between U.S. and Mexican authorities. The problem is sort of substantially worse than it is in Canada. But I think what that shows is that when the Trump administration says that, you know, like Canada has nothing to offer, we need nothing from you, it's actually not true. That it shows that Mexico has understood that there are important things that Mexico can offer and that there are important things that the Trump administration, the United States, needs from Mexico, and that we can find common ground. So it's a very different approach than, you know, I've always thought elbows up is a, you know, anybody who plays hockey knows you're not going to win a hockey game with elbows up. So as an analogy, I've always thought, you know, it might have been great electoral rhetoric, but as a political strategy to engage with the United States, absolutely disastrous. As a smaller player, you'll never win with elbows up. And my sense is that for whatever reason, we're having a hard time engaging with the U.S., and that's, I think, because we're still not doing what the U.S. is asking. I think there's a lot that we can offer the United States, especially in the current circumstances. We can offer hydrocarbons, and we could actually get serious about oil and gas in this country rather than impoverishing ourselves. Look, if we had built, we currently produce about 5.1 sort of million barrels a day. If we had built Energy East, Keystone XL, and the Northern Gateway Pipeline, we'd be exporting 10 million barrels a day. So, you know, that would have given us some leverage on the world stage in terms of instruments of statecraft. So we can do a lot on critical minerals for the Trump administration, on Arctic and Arctic defense. I mean, if Greenland wasn't obvious to people, like, I don't know what was, that the U.S. expects allies to do more. We can do a lot on border security, on immigration, on financial and economic crime in this country. And I think Mexico has understood that there's sort of a combination of things that it can do, whether those are the best interests of Mexico or not, but that sort of they can talk to each other and sort of figure this out. And I have the sense that in Canada, we're at the United States are still somehow not finding the common ground that we need to. It might also be that the U.S. just has bigger fish to fry. This often happens to Canada, that the U.S. loses interests. And so Canada just kind of bides its time and hopes sort of the U.S. attention goes away. I think especially engagement with the cartel shows that, the Mexican problems are much bigger than in Canada in that regard. But that if we got serious about organized crime, transnational organized crime and financial crime in this country, that would be one way. But look at the newly introduced sort of Bill C-12, you know, where we've basically watered down all the most important national security elements in the bill, right? So it's this, you know, we introduced this really tough bill with big fanfare, and then we quietly reintroduce it basically to appease appease sort of civil society critics in an era where there's broad agreement in the United States among allies that Canada is not postured in terms of national security for the 21st century in its legislation, in the way we're structured, in the way we're funded. So, you know, I think leadership is ultimately about hard decisions, and we're not at the point. I think Mexico is making some hard decisions and is showing leadership. I think we might still have a bit of a ways to go here in this country. Yeah, because that's the definition of leadership. You're going to make hard decisions, and you're going to have to own the decisions and the consequences of those decisions. And I think we're still too driven by ideology and electoral priorities, and not enough by what we could and should actually be doing in the best interest of our own sovereignty and in the best interest of our relationship with the United States.
Leaders of these three countries, which are hosting the World Cup, are not on the best of terms right now. Going into the World Cup, the biggest, most complex sporting event to be hosted in history. Nothing ever has been done of this size before in complexity. Now, at the same time as there's been a conflict among these three leaders of different degrees, there has also been obvious increases in security threats globally and domestically and across these borders. If they can keep this event secured and safe for the attendees and as well as people living in the host cities, if they can do that, could the World Cup also offer an opportunity for these three leaders and also people in their cabinet to get together and watch soccer games and just talk? And maybe could that lead to a better future for these three countries? If not, only a better future, but also solve the problem with the Trump trade war and get a new trade agreement in place?
Well, we can hope that, you know, in the spirit of sport and friendship and collegiality, that might be a way to find ourselves again, sort of, and to start thinking in continental terms, that the three countries are better off together than they are apart. But I think the U.S. has set new terms of engagement. And I think Mexico has been willing to engage on the terms set by the United States, and Canada has been much more reticent to engage on those terms, rightly or wrongly. And so my sense is that unless and until Canada is willing to meet the United States on its terms, this will continue to be very difficult. And I think the anti-Americanism tends to play well to a particular constituency in this country. And some politicians like to capitalize on that. And so I fear that rather than seeing the World Cup as an opportunity, we're continuing to try to capitalize on this latent anti-Americanism rather than understanding that, you know, as I always like to say, the Americans are our best friends, whether we like it or not. We share a continent with them. Our security, our prosperity, our democracy are directly tied to our relationship with the United States. And finding that doesn't mean that we don't need to find a better balance, but this idea that somehow we're going to, you know, we have a lot of fault to bear too in that relationship and what's gone wrong. And I think from the Trump administration perspective, there's sort of it's a bit like an estranged marriage where just, you know, each side wants to blame the other and nobody wants to acknowledge that they both have some fault to bear here for some very serious missteps, including by Canada in recent years, very much to the detriment of the United States. Yeah, and we need to have a mature conversation about that. And I hope that FIFA presents that opportunity, but I think it's there's still too many Canadians who I think live in the world that they'd like it the way they'd like it to be and are not prepared to engage with the world the way it is, let alone where the world is going.
And Canada-China relations, we saw what happened in the start of the year with Trump and the U.S. invasion of Venezuela. And the capture of Maduro on the same day that Chinese officials were actually in Caracas meeting with Maduro. Just hours later, that's when the U.S. launched their military operation. Then little time after that, I think it was 10 days after that or so, Mark Carney was in China and he met with Xi Jinping and he announced what he called a strategic partnership with China, a new relationship with China. But China is enabling Russia's war on Ukraine, which has passed the fourth anniversary into the fifth year. And of course, China is also an ally of Iran. So we've got Carney and his plans also to increase Canadian spending on defense. We've got here in BC, David Eby also bidding to bring the NATO Development Bank to Vancouver, whether that's viable or not. We've got this this new relationship with China at the same time as China is trying to divide Canada and U.S. in many ways, and China is still backing those countries that we are spending defense money against in one way, shape, or form. And these are also countries that are involved in foreign interference here on Canadian soil. How does Mark Carney square the circle?
It's puzzling to me. So look, I mean, China is the major enabler of the Iranian missile program. How did the Iranians rebuild their missile program that quickly after their strikes last year, largely with Chinese help? I mean, this is all open source. This is no speculation. How is the Iranian regime able to stay in power? Digital authoritarianism, Huawei and Hikvision as the major purveyors of internet control, censorship, and the reason why Iranians can't communicate with the outside world. But apparently we've decided that this is somehow, this is going to be the savior in terms of helping Canada balance its trade relationship, even though our trade relationship with China is what, like 4% or something like that of our trade. I mean, our trade relationship with the European Union is significantly more important. But there is a reality that middle powers never want to get caught in a superpower conflict. And so I think there's a Canada sort of trying to thread the needle on the realization that the 21st century, China is going to be playing an important role. And we're going to need to have a constructive relationship with China, and our relationship with China will necessarily be different than that of the United States. We're going to need to be able to have constructive relationships with countries like China and India. And I think there's sort of a realist sense about that by the Prime Minister, that we're going to have to make these relationships work. So we're going to have to start somewhere. At the same time, you know, it's like, what's the most important thing that, in my view, we could do for China? I mean, you know, environmentalists are terribly concerned in this country about all the pollution in China and whatnot, and the way China sort of relies on coal. Well, we could be exporting liquid natural gas to China, but of course, those same environmentalists are deeply opposed to building any infrastructure that could actually get us there. So, you know, if I was the Prime Minister, I would have offered up Canadian hydrocarbons. We can see how dependent China is on the Middle East. And I would have said, like, look, we can supply, we can provide you a secure supply for the next 30 years. It would have probably also been a way to provide some stability in the Indo-Pacific, because, you know, China would know that if it invades Taiwan, that supply would be disrupted. You get much more energy out of liquid natural gas than you do out of coal. You know, instead we decided we're going to try to barter around electric vehicles in ways that was probably going to get the Trump administration's backup. So, none of us have access to full information or so of what transpired here. But as I say, I would have traded hydrocarbons for getting the United Front Work Department out of Canada and stopping Chinese interference in this country. And stopping the laundering through Chinese triads, the supply of precursor fentanyls and of pill presses from China, not just into Mexico, but into Canada. Who knows? Maybe they had that conversation and the Chinese regime wasn't interested. Maybe the Chinese is holding back in order to try to see what where they can extort further concessions from Canada. But we are currently caught in obviously a very difficult relationship with the United States, and we are caught in the spat, in the trade spat between China and the United States. And that's not going to be good for Canadian prosperity, regardless of where this is going to go. So we're going to have to figure out the relationship with the US, and we're going to have to figure out the relationship with China. And we're going to have to do it in ways that also serve our national best interests. And I'm not sure we're able to square all of that with some of the, if we persist on the politics of ideology that we've seen in recent years. I think the Carney government is trying to get to a more pragmatic approach, but it also has to keep its cabinet and caucus inside. And so for my part, as much as I might not be particularly thrilled about what I saw about the trip from China, what came out of it, I'm willing to give the Prime Minister the benefit of the doubt that this is a first step in trying to reconfigure both relationships, and that the Prime Minister has a plan for those relationships. And we're just not quite sure yet what that plan is, but that he has a plan.
Well, thank you again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. Professor Christian Luprecht of the Department of Political Science and Economics at the Royal Military College of Canada. And hopefully by the time we speak again, that many of the major powers in the world figure out more about diplomacy than about war, so that I don't have to ask you the question about World War III again. So thanks again for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Canadian envoy seeks closer ties as office marks 40th year in Taiwan. Marie-Louise Hannon, executive director of the Canadian Trade Office in Taipei, said the office was founded in 1986 with only 3 employees. 4 decades later, it has grown to a staff of 50. Beginning with early Canadian missionaries such as George Leslie Mackay, who founded schools, churches, and hospitals across northern Taiwan 150 years ago, and extending to the more than 60,000 Canadians who live here today, people-to-people exchanges have continued to flourish, according to Hannon. In ABC News Australia, fuel and freight woes from Middle East conflict could end some carrot farms in Western Australia, warns industry body. Western Australia's carrot export industry has lost its main customer due to conflict in the Middle East. Last year, Australia exported more than 48,000 tons of carrots worth $40 million to the Middle East. Some farmers have told the ABC that they will be forced to plow millions of dollars worth of carrots into the ground as it is impossible to ship them to the region. In Hong Kong Free Press, MPs call on UK government to urgently extradite Manosphere influencer Andrew Tate from Hong Kong. Tate and his brother Tristan, who face human trafficking and rape charges in Romania and the UK, were first spotted in Hong Kong on March 14th. Quote, "Here I am in Hong Kong, I'm going nowhere, come get me," the British-American influencer said in a 4-minute video posted on March 18th, captioned, "Innocent men don't run."
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, drug users are getting hospitalized with deep, horrific burns. Portland doctors think they know why. The trusty locking butane torch is a potent, focused heat source, reliable even in the wind. Some increasingly see it as a public health scourge. Between early 2016 and early 2024, Dr. Mark Thomas, a surgeon at the Oregon Burn Center, found more than 12,000 Oregon Medicaid members were treated for acute burns, 4+ people per day. Notably, people who use smokable drugs comprise more than half of these people, a rate of 2 acute burns per day, despite making up just 15% of the state's Medicaid population. In Cascadia Daily News, Washington State Ferries enters 7th season without cross-border service. Agency says it plans to bring back the Anacortes to Sydney route around 2030. That's when it expects to receive the first of 3 new 144 auto hybrid electric ferries on order. The agency emphasized that it has not given up on reviving the route. At the moment, the ferry system could not resume sailing to Sydney even if it had a spare boat. That is because it currently lacks a vessel certified to sail internationally. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Federal crypto crackdown targets BC companies with foreign directors. And mixed messages about Vancouver's other FIFA event. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
ski and snowboard instructors and ski and snowboard patrollers in British Columbia, the people who keep people safe on the slopes. It's spring, but here's hoping the season is not over yet.
And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 22nd, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 22nd of March in 1894, Montreal beat Ottawa in the first Stanley Cup final, 3-1? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.